All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed show today, and it's a really unique show, all right? I'm really looking forward to you hearing it and me hearing from you about what you think about it, all right? So at the back end of the show, you know, I decided to do this segment in particular because of the horrific misogynistic murders that were committed in Santa Barbara over the weekend, over last weekend. And I thought it would be really important for people to get a sense of where the hell does all this hatred of women come from and what does it serve, you know? And so I went to the film of Bob Avakian's speech, B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And I listened to it for a while, and I found a segment that I want people to hear in relation to all this, as well as in relation to the oppression of women overall. And that segment is called The Oppression of Women Bound Up with This System, A Driving Force for Revolution. All right, so that's going to be at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking with P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is an evolutionary biologist, and he's at the University of Minnesota. He's also the author of the book, The Happy Atheist, all right? And that's one of the things P.Z. is known throughout the world as, is The Happy Atheist, okay? And that book is a really, really exciting and actually really provocative book. And I think everybody will get a kick out of hearing this interview, and it'll give you a lot to think about, all right? And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to bring you a special segment. And this is something that, you know, I oftentimes bring you films that you may not be running in your area, things like that. But a number of the films that I saw at Sundance this year at the Sundance Film Festival are available on Netflix. And this is one of those films. It's called This May Be the Last Time. And it's from a Native American director named Sterling Harjo. I had the opportunity to interview Sterling Harjo at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and this is the interview we're going to be listening to in just a minute. In This May Be the Last Time, Harjo explores the mystery of his grandfather's death and the role Native song played in his family's history of grief, as well as the role this ceremonial music played in the history and lives of the Muscogee Creek and Seminole people of the Creek Nation in Oklahoma. Joining us now is Sterling Harjo, who is the director of the film This May Be the Last Time. Really, really, really engaging, and I mean, you had me from the moment the film started all the way through, and
thank you.
I was really, really, it posed a lot of questions for me, it opened my eyes to a lot of things, so I was really anxious to talk to you, so welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let's start by you giving people a sense of what's the story. Tell people the story in broad outlines and a broad sweep so they can know what we're talking about.
It's actually a story about songs. It's a story about Muscogee Creek and Seminole hymns. I myself am Muscogee Creek and Seminole. It's a story about songs and how they're interwoven within the community and how they're used in the community, how the songs were used on the Trail of Tears, how the songs are used as their encouragement songs. And it's really about the history of these songs. It's a really fascinating story about how the story of these songs were adapted from Scottish hymns. Missionaries brought these hymns over, and then you have this sort of intermingling between these three cultures, which is in the Southeast, which is American Indian, Scottish, and the black slave community. And you have this singing that's adopted out of it, and the Muscogee Creek hymns are directly inspired by, they're their own thing, they're inspired by the Native traditional songs, but they're also inspired by black slave spirituals and the Scottish hymns and sort of made into their own thing.
All right, that's some of the stuff I want to explore deeper as we go along. But what compelled you to make this film?
You know, it's just been something that I've always wanted to make. I realized when I left home how rare it is. I grew up with these songs. I've heard these songs my whole life. They're funeral songs. They're, you know, they remind you of people that have passed on. I've wanted to make the film my whole life. All of my fictional narrative features, I put these songs in. I usually put some of these songs in the films. And I really just wanted to tell the story because I wanted to show people, and specifically the people in my community, how unique and beautiful they are.
Now, how did you yourself discover these songs? I mean, in terms of, you said you grew up with them, but was it, you know, like, I thought I remembered you saying a little bit, like, even the language took some getting used to in terms of your own abilities.
Well, I mean, really, it was just, I grew up with them. I don't remember the first time I heard them. They've just always been a part of aspects of my life, whether I was getting dragged to church as a child or whether I was at a funeral, I would hear these songs. And so you don't pay attention to them necessarily. You just hear them, and then all of a sudden you learn the tunes of these songs, and they just sort of become a part of your life. And then you find yourself one day being able to sing some of them. The language is all in Muscogee language, so, you know, if you're not a Muscogee language speaker, it takes some getting used to and learning and developing the language, and that's You know, I've spent most of my life trying to learn the language, and the songs have really helped.
Now, when you talk about them being the songs that actually play so much a part in people's lives, one of the things that happens is they also seem to have a huge amount of, well, there's the religious aspect, but then they play a part in the other aspects of people's lives as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's the religious aspect of the songs, but some people sing them and they're not religious. They're just really beautiful songs that sometimes, you know, I would consider myself religious to a point, but very open as far as religion goes and other people's religion goes. But for me, these songs and our traditional songs, that is the religion to me. You know, mm-hmm. it's the power of these songs that I love.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the other aspects of life that the songs fit into or are part of, mm-hmm. give people a sense of what that is. Because on the one hand, that's what I was trying to get at. On the one hand, you know, sometimes, look, people can understand church hymns mm-hmm. to a certain yeah. extent. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But then there's other things that come out yeah. in there that, you know, express other facets of people's lives. When you take us into that community, what you see there actually both concentrates historically as well as the present, mm-hmm. a life that a lot of people just don't know about, and a life that has many aspects to yeah. it, from the down deep, pressed down aspect to mm-hmm. to the celebratory aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, these songs are, you know, you hear them in church, sure, they're hymns, but you also, people sing them to encourage themselves. Some people just use the songs as, like, you wake up in the morning. There's one song that's called a morning song. It's called Hat Hayatkin, and it translates to, you know, beginning in the morning, I will pray, and then I'll continue praying throughout the day, and different variations of that sort of premise. People sometimes use that song in the morning as a reminder to encourage themselves, to pray, to be thankful for being alive. And some people just use these songs as encouragement for themselves, you know, if they're feeling down, or even if they want to remember someone that's passed on, to honor that person, they'll use these songs to invoke memories of those people that have passed on. Mm-hmm. And there's so many other ways, though, you know, like these songs are just, you know, people that don't go to church anymore, they still remember some of the songs and they'll sing them.
Well, one thing I was wondering, too, was you grew up in that community?
Yeah.
Well, so then it wasn't really coming into the community
no.
for you. So, but when you made it clear to people that you wanted to do a film about these songs and about all the things that were concentrated in the things you're just talking about, and also look, there was a lot of very sort of, a lot of people stripped themselves almost naked emotionally mm-hmm. and when mm-hmm. they were talking about, you know, their association with the songs. How do people feel about, one, you doing a film on the songs, and how did you feel about actually bringing that to film?
Yeah. You know, I gained a lot of trust. First of all, I grew up in the community, so there's a trust for that. But people in that community also know my films, my feature films, and they're very receptive to them. People love those films. They're, you know, if being a blockbuster was measured in my community, it would be, I would be rich, because people like those films. And it's because I use some of these songs and different aspects of the culture to put in the films. So whenever I approached people about doing this film, they all knew my work and they were willing to do it. They trusted me. A lot of that is because I'm from the community, but also people were really ready to talk about the songs. It's like they'd been waiting to talk about the songs and really open up about them, because it's not something that anyone talks about. Or, you know, no one intellectualizes it. I mean, it's just your life.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Native American filmmaker-director Sterling Harjo about his film, This May Be the Last Time. Well, that led me to this thought and this question. It's the film, part of the framework of the film is your grandfather's death.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story that it frames the whole thing in terms of how you start out and you're talking about what happened there, and then, you know, as it rolls out, you know, you dig into that deeper. And one of the things that struck me is here you're doing this film about these songs that are, like, you know, very traditional, very deeply set in people, mm-hmm. and yet your grandfather basically was a jazz musician,
mm-hmm.
and that was the music that drove his life. How did you see that coming together?
What do you mean, like, how did I...
Well, just what you thought about it, you know?
Just the connection of him
yeah.
being a musician and...
Yeah, and the fact that did these songs also play a big role in his life, or was it more like, I know he didn't get into a lot of the Christian mm-hmm. songs.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that's sort of unknown. There's a lady in the film that said that he was a song leader at the church, which makes me think he knew these songs really well. Of course, I didn't know him, but I know that his passion was for kind of Western swing, rock and roll, country and Western. You know, he loved playing stand-up bass, so that's where his passion lied. But for me, it was really interesting because this is a film about music. And we were always told that he chose music instead of the church. You know, like he said you could only serve one master. But in the end, he comes back to these songs because these people are singing these songs as they look for his body, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of that idea, and I feel like I identify with that, leaving this community, but you'll always come back, whether it's by choice or by death. You know, I have a place that I'm going to be buried at when I die. And it's back in that community, you know, and it's where my grandma's buried, it's where a lot of people are buried in my family. So you don't go away from it too much. And I feel like for me, I wanted to come back to it sooner because I realized how unique parts of the culture were. Once I left, I realized how unique these songs were, and it made me want to come back and kind of really just pay attention to where I'm from.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the point that I was trying to get into, is that, you know, when you talk about what music meant to your grandfather and what music meant to the people, and mm-hmm. both how they coincided and differed. And mm-hmm. it was a very interesting point.
Well, and I think it also speaks to the complexities of Christianity as a religion with Native people, because, you know, it's the religion of the oppressor. It's the religion of the people that came and committed genocide for the most part. And so for Native people to really accept that religion, they have to make it their own. And for me, I don't know what the answers are to that. It's just a question that I've always had. Like, and I asked my uncle, and you don't know that he's my uncle, but I ask him in the film, I'm like, how are you okay? How are you at peace with yourself? And I think he gives a beautiful answer. It's not going to be a satisfying answer to everyone, but it is to him. But it's just something that has always been really interesting to me. And I feel like there was a point in my life where I kind of hid that. Hmm. I didn't talk about it. I was a little embarrassed of it. I only talked about the traditional side of my life. And I necessarily didn't talk about how I grew up in these churches as well. But for me, I got to the point where that I shed all of that sort of guilt, you know. And this film was really just like, I'm going to put it all out there. And, you know, this is where I grew up.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Native American filmmaker-director Sterling Harjo about his film, This May Be the Last Time. And it's a film about the Muscogee Creek Seminole people of the Creek Nation in Oklahoma. And the film is available on Netflix, so you can see it now.
I thought that was a really interesting part of the film where you posed that question. That was actually what was in my mind mm-hmm. when I was asking mm-hmm. that, because you posed that question and it came off like really like bam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we won't get into the answers. We'll leave something for people to see. Yeah. But there is an element too. I mean, it is true. It's they brought genocide. They brought this. But the religion itself, to a certain extent, Christianity to a certain extent, and you see this running through the film as well. You know, people make peace mm-hmm. with a lot of things that I think they really shouldn't be making mm-hmm. peace for. And I understand yeah. what happens, but I, yeah. you know, but still the religion, and having grown up in the Catholic religion, mm-hmm. you know, until I rejected it, I know what it teaches you
yeah.
on paper anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was curious about that in terms of how people saw this, because these songs also tell a story of, you know, the terrible oppression that faced the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear yeah. people talking about this, about the Trail of Tears, you know, and, mm-hmm. and so if we could dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a strange thing, you know, because these songs do talk about the Trail of Tears, and they were sung on the Trail of Tears, and they were meant to encourage the people to keep going. I think people really grasp a hold of the forgiveness message in the Christian faith, and also the promise of something better, you know, the promise of things, you know, if you have faith, things will be okay. And, you know, Christianity came in a really tough time, I feel like, for the people. And so the people that embraced that really were in desperate situations, and something about that religion spoke to them. But on the whole, Muscogee Creek and Seminole people are super, super spiritual people, whether they're traditional or whether they're Christian. And that had to be the case back in the day because all our whole calendar of life was built around our traditional religion. So we're praying before everything. Everything is involved with fasting and prayer. You know, you don't go hunting without fasting beforehand. And you don't, you know, the new crops come in, well, it's all about the religion, it's all about fasting, it's all about purifying the land. And so it's such a spiritual world that Christianity just became a part of that, I think.
Well, here's a question that I have to ask because, mm-hmm. you know, for me, I'm a revolutionary,
no.
you know, and for me, I keep thinking, okay, you know, and I've seen what Christianity's done to people around the world, mm-hmm. religion of any kind, any mm-hmm. type, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, in particular, that element of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's not a whole hell of a lot in my mind that Native people should be forgiving the oppressors for, you know. And even at that time, and I understand that the horror of the Trail of Tears. I mean, there's that one scene in the film where the man's mm-hmm. talking and he's talking about what he sees and, he, mm-hmm. and you're walking down this wooded path, mm-hmm. which was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
All you're doing is taking the camera through the woods.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's coming to life for people is the slaughter mm-hmm. and the rape mm-hmm. and the pillaging of the Native peoples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're hearing this voice tell this story.
Mm.
And at the same time, you know, that's what I keep thinking about. With these songs, you know, and with the religion, the forgiveness aspect, that's really, it's a very contradictory thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's something I've probably asked myself my whole life. And, you know, it's like, it's one of those things where I don't know the answer and I feel the way you do. You know, I feel like the Native people shouldn't be apologizing for anything. For me, I really identify with the traditional side, our traditional religion. It's beautiful. It's a song is very much the center of it. I think that's why these songs come about too. But for me, I can never look past the fact that Europeans told them that religion was wrong. I can't look past that, and I can't look past what happened. So for me, you know, I go to church and I'm a little, you know, I don't feel like I belong there, you know, because I don't agree with a lot of things people say. But as soon as one of these songs start up, then I'm in, and then I'm sold, you know, and I'm singing. And that's what's beautiful to me is the songs. The religion for me, there's so many contradictory things that go straight against being a Native person. That I can't look past it, you know. So for me, it's a very difficult thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I'll just finish with this one comment on this subject. I mean, because it's also true that and you can see this. Why would the oppressors put religion on people?
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, it's not just the okay, you know, just accept this, but it's also it prevents people from really understanding what's happening in the world and why it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on that basis, figuring out what the hell you can do about it.
Yeah.
You know? So. To me, it's like there's a whole program that goes with the religion. So
no, for sure, and it's economical. It's yeah. it's about life. It's about accepting. You know that, like you said, is accepting what's happening to them. You know,
you're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Native American filmmaker director Sterling Harjo about his film This May Be the Last Time. And it's a film about the ceremonial music of the Muscogee Creek Seminole people of the Creek Nation.
Leads me to this question. The similarity that was raised in the film, which I think must have blown your mind, I know it blew my mind, the similarity with the spirituals and the mm-hmm. slave songs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, that's just, that really blows my mind, you know. It's at the same time, it makes so much sense. You know, it's like we had this cross-cultural sort of exchange with freed black slaves and black slaves down in the South, and our cultures intermingled, and of course our songs are going to be similar, you know, and our traditional songs are even similar. They're call and response singing. They sound like a jazz percussion, our songs do. But the Native people were forcibly removed from that area, so that connection's lost in history. And in the film, I just tried to sort of delicately bring up that there was three cultures at work here that were inspiring each other to, and their cultures were similar. And for me, it's like, not enough has been done in the media and film, that connection of, the connection of people of African descent and Native people. They were right next to each other. In Oklahoma, there's black towns right next to Indian towns. And they even spoke each other's language, you know. So, you know, I would just feel grateful that I was able to talk about that.
Well, yeah. And look, I was thinking about the Seminole people.
Yeah.
And the mixture that developed and that defined the Seminole mm-hmm. people after a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
There's this one tribal group in Mississippi that is still fighting for its recognition.
No.
And they were, and that happened, that came up in Katrina.
Yeah.
You know, where they weren't recognized by the state or the federal government or something. And yeah. So they were left high and dry, or not high and dry, but ruined because mm-hmm. of the, you know, the hurricane and whatnot. But that connection is very deep. And that's why I was like really fascinated by the connection between the spiritual songs, and this, and which oftentimes did. I mean, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot mm-hmm. was a song that actually announced a lot of slave, you know, how yeah. the slaves were leaving and stuff, right? And I thought that that element of that subversive element to the mm-hmm. songs.
Well, yeah, there's a, they are subversive, and they're, the songs are code, just like a lot of the slave spirituals were. They're, you know, and the blues was, it's like where sometimes I'm going to get to heaven means I'm going to get to the end of this trail of tears. I'm going to be home with my loved ones. And they would sing this as code because the soldiers were right there. They were listening, you know. And so they would sing these things, and they would sing them in ways that they didn't know what they were talking about. Some of them are about heaven, but some of them are actually about getting to Indian territory.
Now let's talk about the more surprising connection, the Scottish Highland music.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing, you know. Like, you know, it's this lining out style of singing that's basically the, you know, a lot of times the Scottish priests would be the ones that could read. And so they would read a line from the Psalms or sing it, and then the whole congregation would repeat it in song. That's really sort of how some of this style of singing developed. And, you know, and at the same time, Scottish people were also oppressed in their own right and come from tribal people. And I think they were able to identify with the blacks and with the native people in the Southeast. And I think that's why this singing sort of, I guess, percolates with, the style of singing sort of percolates down there, because they had things that they could all three cultures could identify with.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on this, what was the, you know, aside from the things we've just been talking mm-hmm. about, what was the thing that you discovered that you never expected to discover?
Yeah. Well, that one, I think that it's a pretty surprising thing. And it came about at the end of the film when I was finished. I finally had a break. I finished the film. I was going crazy. I was, you know, doing a sound mix, Skywalker, yada, yada. And I go home. And I talked to my dad, who, it's his dad that we're talking about in the film. And I started talking to him about, you know, things. And he said, you know, I feel like I'm glad you did this. It's a tribute to our family. And I feel like I've gotten closer to my dad. And for someone to say that as I've always grown up with my father as a person who didn't have a father. He, you know, he was 5 years old when he died. And so to have my dad say that, it's like, you know, if it never sees the light of day or whatever, like, that's worth it to me that my dad got to come up here and watch it. And the thing is I heard this story hundreds of times, but until I made the film and finished it, and I was talking to my dad about it, and he started talking about all of these things and how it affected his sister and knowing that this, you realize that, oh yeah, it's a real thing that happened. It's not just this story that I've heard 100 times. Real people were affected by this man's death, and real people searched for him. And that's the same thing with the Trail of Tears. The Trail of Tears is talked about a lot as this sort of thing that just gets tossed around, but it was a real event where people actually walked the hundreds of miles to Oklahoma, and thousands of people died along the way and drowned in the Mississippi River. And so, you know, that's what I want it to come across, is this is a very real thing. You know, it's not just these things we read in one page of our history book, you know. And with my grandfather, it was like I realized how many people were affected, you know, and I'm affected even, you know.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Native American filmmaker-director Sterling Harjo about his film, This May Be the Last Time. And it's a film about the ceremonial music of the Muscogee Creek Seminole people of the Creek Nation. And the film is available now on Netflix.
I think I have maybe 2 more questions, and we have probably about 4 or 5 more minutes.
Okay.
The one point is, what, you know, there's a point that's made in the film a lot of times that, and even in the title of the film, This May Be the Last Time. Let's talk about what the title means.
This May Be the Last Time for me, it means a lot of things. It means, like, you know, we need to really learn these songs and keep these songs alive, because this could be the last time that we're all listening to them or whatever. It also, that song specifically, it's the title of a song, Espogades Omes Kithiskos. You hear that song a lot, at invitation, when they're asking people to come find Jesus, and or at funerals, where it's like, this is the last, you know, this could be the last time we're ever going to see each other, you know, and that holds a lot of weight. Specifically, though, this song comes out of the 1800s. It's also a slave spiritual, exact same lyrics. And this song moves through music history where there's blues adaptations, there's gospel adaptations. The Staple Singers have a hit with the song with the same lyrics. Keith Richard from the Rolling Stone hears it. They adopted it into The Last Time, which of course everyone knows. But the native version stayed the same all of these years, but you can see the trace of this music through history.
That's it. I have to tell you, I was just, you know, I was right there all along until you got the Stones. I thought, whoa,
wait a minute. Isn't that crazy?
Amazing.
It's amazing.
Tell me this, Stone, and this is the last question, but what will you take away from this film yourself personally? What's the deepest thing you're going to take away from this film?
You know, I think that the fact that I get to almost do like, you know, it almost feels like I preserve these songs. You know, people talk about we need to save these songs, we need to teach these songs. Well, now I have this film that is it's its own thing, and people forever after I'm gone can watch this film, and if they don't know any of these songs, they still have examples of these songs that are on this film, and that'll be here forever. And that's pretty amazing to think about.
Sterling Harjo, thank you very much for the film and for the interview.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have just been talking with Native American filmmaker, director, Sterling Harjo, about his latest film, This May Be the Last Time. And again, if you want to get more information about the film, you can check out the website of This Land Films, which is a subsidiary of This Land Press Media Company, which publishes This Land Magazine in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that website is thislandpress.com. You can also Google This May Be the Last Time or Sterling Harjo and get all the information you want. And don't forget, you can see the film right there on Netflix right now, so don't miss it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with P.Z. Myers from the University of Minnesota and the Happy Atheist, as he's known all over the world. So stay tuned. It's hell down here, and we got to make a change. And you know that's true, okay, on every level and every part of human life. We got to make a change. We got to make a big change. And we are talking about now. We're joining, you know, right now. I'm really pleased to welcome back somebody who seems to have gotten lost, you know. We were going to do it. I'm going to blame it on him, and he'll come back and say, it's your fault. We haven't talked to each other for quite some time. He's been busy writing his book, and his book is The Happy Atheist, and it's an incredibly important, I think it's a very moving book. It's one, and I'm serious about that. It's P.Z. Myers, and P.Z. Myers is the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Feringula! See, P.Z., I still say it, I have to say it that way, all right?
Well, it's pretty good.
Yeah. And he describes what he's doing as this, and I think it's kind of interesting. He says, I'm an atheist swimming in a sea of superstition surrounded by well-meaning good people with whom I share a culture and similar concerns, and there's only one thing I can do. I have to laugh. But actually, folks, P.Z. Myers does much more than that. And this book, The Happy Atheist, is a remarkable piece of work. I think it takes you the entire spectrum of basically, I mean, laughing, sitting back saying, what the hell? What's he talking about? And a lot of other things. And it's been met with, actually, I was surprised at how much controversy, although maybe that shows I've been living in the woods too long, but I was surprised by the controversy that has been engendered by this. And now we're going to jump into our discussion with P.Z. Myers. P.Z., welcome to the show, damn it.
Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to hear you. Good to hear you. Man, where were you, by the way?
this has been a difficult semester. I've been teaching, just nonstop teaching and grading and writing, and it's been busy.
Well, why this book, brother? Why this book?
Well, I wanted to give kind of a taste of what it's like reading Feringula. That there's a good dose of anti-religious sentiment, so I wail on religion quite a bit. But I also try to counterbalance it by including stories about science and why science is a so much more powerful way of looking at the world and seeing how things really are.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when I talk about it being controversial, and sometimes in terms of the critics, and I read some of these critics of the book, they were supposed to be doing a critical analysis of the book, and they looked at it, and a lot of them were just sort of, not a lot, but a number of them badmouthed the book for not taking the orientation of gentle persuasion in the face of the tsunami of religion and other forms of superstition in the world today. Let's talk about that a little, because it really is. It's a way of sort of saying, well, tut, 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 you know, interesting, but really, you know, not that interesting, and he's just far too harsh.
I mean, you read that little bit about how I was, you know, I'm surrounded by people who are actually well-intentioned. And I think that's the key thing, is that I can recognize that people want to be good, that the people that surround me that are involved in the Christian faith definitely are there for the best of intentions, but intentions don't count. What matters is what you do with your life and what you do with your ideas. And so here we've got these nice people who are very sweet, and they talk about keeping women in their place and how gays shouldn't marry and how global warming is all nonsense and how we shouldn't teach good biology in our classrooms. I really can't be too gentle with them. They have to be regarded as people who are actually betraying their own values. So, yeah, I'm critical, and I think we need to be critical now.
But you know what, PZ? What I also found in the book, I found, look, you take a certain stance towards the purveyors of this stuff. You take a certain stance towards the people that are out there, the Christian fascists that are running all over the place, all of this stuff, you take a certain stance towards them, and the people that are really the hardcore foot soldiers of that whole fascistic movement, you take a hard stance to them, but there is a way where you walk people through things. I mean, I found hilarious and also very, very moving, your exposure of the entire Easter myth, you know, which was, you know, and it isn't because, you know, look, I liked getting Easter eggs as much as anybody, although I was troubled once I turned, 35 and realized that rabbits don't lay chocolate eggs. Right? But the Easter mythology, this is a way that you think you kind of walk people through all the contradictions that are presented in this story. And you do that in many places where you actually force people in a way to confront the contradictoriness of what they're believing and what reality is.
Yeah, I mean, because this is what I face all the time. I'm out there directly confronting what has to be considered lunacy. I mean, things like creationists, they're absurd. But when you actually talk with the people who are promoting these ideas, they're not stupid. They're actually intelligent people who are trying to make sense of the world, and they've just been steered off in this terribly wrong direction. So I think it's appropriate that the way you try to get at this is not to condemn them, you know, not to dismiss their concerns, but to do a little education, actually teach them something about why they are wrong. And I have high hopes, and I've had good success, that many people will respond to that and recognize that, oh, there is a reason we're doing this. It's not a very good one. Maybe we should stop.
Yeah. That's true. That's the people who believe the stuff. Then the people who actually believe it and push it, that's a whole other story. And I think actually one of the things that you do, you talk about keeping on the people who are caught up in the whole swamp of religion. There's something that you talk about, which I found really also very, very important. You talk about how religion, although I have to tell you, PZ, is this really a word? Religion infantilizes people.
Yes, it's a real word.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I was just saying, I'm trying to treat people as intelligent human beings who can respond to information and facts and ideas. And religion doesn't. Religion says, oh, you're a child, you must accept this or you'll go to hell. You don't get a choice. Religion does not give you the tools to think about how we came to believe in these things, because they don't want you to do that. They want you just to accept and move on.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with P.Z. Myers, who's the author of Fringilla, the most popular science blog in the world, and he's now the author of The Happy Atheist as well. Now, P.Z., when you talk about how religion, the impact religion has on people, it has a very harmful impact on people. And one of the things that it does is when you talk about religion, how it's always been, and it's not just Christianity, most religions have something to do with patriarchy and misogyny, and there's a whole thing about how that infantilizing people is tied up and related to the enforcement of patriarchy and misogyny.
Yes, much of religion is about controlling people's lives. It's a way to dictate to other people how they should live in order to fit in. And often tied to that is setting up the privileged members of the tribe and giving them special powers and special entitlements and making excuses for treating other people as lesser beings. You know, you can't read the Bible without seeing over and over again that this book is saying that certain people are the chosen people, and they are allowed to go into strange countries and kill people, murder their children, rape their women, and it's all good with God. This is a kind of barbarian morality that they're promoting. So, yeah, it's not a good thing. Promoted a lot of atrocities in history.
Yeah, yeah. And it also, God paying attention to that stuff also takes away from his ability to determine the outcome of football games, boxing matches, and card games. It's like, what the hell,
important
man?
Stuff.
Yeah. Which is, it's really interesting because this all-powerful God spends so much time making sure your love life works out and helping you pick exactly the right lottery ticket. It's really insane. So, and you said that. Let me talk about the purpose-free life. There's something you tackle head-on on this, and that is the idea that to have a purpose in life, a purposeful life, requires two things. The idea that it requires a God to give you that purpose, and that it requires a soul in a certain sense. And you come out and you slam both of those things. Let's talk about that.
That's a very popular book, The Purpose-Driven Life, and I actually read it and was horrified because apparently our purpose is to live here in suffering and in sin and then die and then spend eternity as slaves to a God. And this is considered the purpose we're living for? This is something we should be aspiring to? It's a pretty terrible story. And the truth is that when you actually look at the biology, when you look at the physics, when you look at the science of how this universe operates, it says exactly the opposite. It says that we're the products of chance and accident, that there is no particular purpose to your life except for the one you give yourself. And I think that's the important message, is that if you're looking for a purpose in life, don't go looking for a magical being in the sky to give it to you. You have to find it for yourself, and you have to find it in your interactions with other human beings.
It's important, you know, even when you talk about the soulless thing, I thought that was extremely important, because there's a way that in the age we live in, and especially people who have sort of view themselves as, I'm more enlightened, I'm this, I'm that, people still have this idea that somehow there's some intangible essence of you that goes on forever and ever, and they really have a very hard time recognizing that, no, there isn't, and two, how deeply connected that very concept is to religion.
And it's also a way that you can be manipulated. If you believe that your life is brief, transient, short, temporary, just a stepping stone on the way to an immortal life as a disembodied soul, then you will listen to people who say that here's the way to make things really good for your eternity, even if it makes it suck for your now and your life. Mm-hmm. And atheism turns out all around. They say, no, that what's really important is what's going on in your life. And what we ought to be thinking about is how we can make the world a better place for living human beings rather than dead ones who don't exist.
Okay, let me write that one down. PZ, we got one more question for you. There's so much to talk about, and I would really encourage people to get this, because there's a point, like, why are science and religion in conflict? I know you and I have talked about this a lot, and I think it's related to the question I want to ask you, which is one of the things I found really moving about the book is you sort of end it with a chapter that I think goes against what everybody thinks, the popular epistemology about what atheists are like, or what people who are into this are like. When you talk about, you titled the chapter, "We Stand in Awe at the Heights Our People Have Achieved." And you're talking about that. When you're talking about that, when you read that, you're talking about the understanding of reality, the changing of reality to meet human needs, the poetry, the art, all of human life. And it's really a very poetic point in the book. And I think there's many, many points of poetry in the book. And I think this one really caps it all off. So let's talk about that. Science and religion in conflict, and this last thing about we stand in awe.
Well, yeah, because this is the thing that I think really religion really steals from us, is when you say that all the great things that people have accomplished have been by the influence of an invisible man in the sky. You're stealing from us, that you're stealing from the people who have accomplished so much, that what we need to do is, instead of looking to mysteries in the skies and saying, oh, thank you very much, we need to turn to each other, because that's where the greatness lies, is in the human race as a whole. And I think that one of the things atheism has to do is promote that more, this idea that we have to respect each other because we're the ones who are doing everything, not gods, not priests, nothing like that. It's all us.
And there's so much more we could do once we really grasp all of that.
Yes. Well, you're wasting your life if you're pursuing a deity. That I didn't talk about it in the book, but I think one of the tragic things in our history is that so many men and women have basically locked themselves away and thrown themselves out of the actual productive part of living by going into religious orders and pursuing priesthoods and spending careers basically lying to large congregations.
All right, PZ, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we will have you back again real soon, man.
Excellent.
All right, All right. So take care.
Thank you.
All right, PZ, take care, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is a professor at the University of Minnesota. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Feringula, and he is also the author of the book, The Happy Atheist, all right? And it's making atheists happy all over the world and scaring the hell out of all those various theists of all stripes, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a selection from Bob Avakian talking about the oppression of women, bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. So stay tuned.
Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Woman is the nigger of the world. Think about it. Do something about it. We'll make her paint her face and dance. If she won't be a slave, we say that she don't love us. If she's here, we say she's trying to be a man. By putting her down, we pretend so hard that she's above us. Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. You don't believe me? Take a look at the one you're with. Woman is the slave. If you believe me, you better scream about it.
Woo-hoo-hoo. All right, welcome back. That was John Lennon with his song Woman is the Nigger of the World, a song that continues to have very deep meaning in the world today. And especially, you know, when you're sitting here and you're looking back at the recent terrible misogynistic murders up in Santa Barbara, California, you've got to think about this. What is it? What is it that in this society that makes women among the most hated beings on the face of the planet? What is it in this world that allows us to continue to go on? Not only allows it, but actually, you know, foments it and feeds it and just, you know, pushes it out there as the way to act. Well, when I was thinking about all that, I thought that what we really need to do is we really need to take a listen to something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this is contained in the film of his speech, B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And it's a segment that's on the oppression of women. It's called The Oppression of Women, Bound Up with This System, A Driving Force for Revolution. Check this out. There's a whole hell of a lot to think about and to learn from in this segment.
Millions of women and girls are enslaved in prostitution and in the degradation of the ever more vicious and violent pornography. Many forced into this as well, not only out of economic hardship, but literal brutality. A number of years ago, I gave a talk called Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. And in that, I spoke to the fact that a comrade in our party had pointed out to me in relation to an earlier talk I gave, Revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about, that there was a very real and vivid parallel between the situation of women, particularly in pornography and prostitution, and the way the phenomenon that I described in beginning that talk, Revolution. I began that talk with descriptions of the postcards of the hanging. Now think about this. Literally in this country, up until the 1950s and into the early 1960s, in many of our lifetimes, black people were being repeatedly lynched. But that's not all. Usually this took place in the South. And many times, when these black men in particular would be lynched, it would be done in a carnival atmosphere. People would be notified in advance that this was going to happen. People, whole families, including little children, would come to picnic at the site of the lynching. And when the black man's body was lynched, mutilated, and burned, pieces of the mutilated body would be handed out to some in the crowd as trophies. This is the history of this country. And I know it's hard to hear, but we need to face the reality of what the history of this country and how it's been built actually is. And then photographs would be taken of the burned, mutilated, and lynched bodies of these black men. And postcards would be made and they would be sold around the country. And this comrade pointed out, and I spoke to this in Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution, that what goes on, particularly in the increasingly violent and vicious pornography, is very much along the same lines as the postcards of the hanging. The titillation of men through the physical torture and degradation of women, which is becoming more and more the norm and more mainstream in pornography. We should all think about the fact that one of the most popular forms of pornography as it's being more and more mainstream is rape pornography, depicting literally the woman being raped. And this comrade also pointed out, and I think it's very important to think about, that you can do in this society today to women what you could not do to any other group without a huge outcry. I mean, think about what's depicted in pornography, even so-called softcore, let alone hardcore, vicious and violent pornography. Imagine if someone made a film depicting black people in grotesque caricature with gigantic teeth and a big smile eating watermelons and dancing around saying, "Yes, sir, massa, yes, sir, massa." Can you imagine that you could have that done without a huge outcry? No, and that's very right. It should not be able to be done without a huge outcry. Or imagine if you literally showed lynchings and depicted them as a source of titillation. But yet you can do what I've been describing in pornography, and not only is there not a huge outcry, but it's being more and more mainstream. And by the way, it's multi-billion dollar business. It's not just some sleazy old men in San Fernando Valley who are churning this out. This involves big banks and financial institutions. It involves big hotel chains involved in multi-billion dollar business. And it's becoming more, as I said, more and more mainstream. Even the television programs, which are not pornographic themselves, literally, how often do you hear when talking about guys, "Oh, let's watch some porn"? It's just integrated into the story as if it's just perfectly natural. And then think about the content that I've been just touching on and can't really give full life to. I mean, it's just so disgusting. It's so outrageous. Think about this content that's being mainstreamed. And along with this, women are subjected to continual assaults on their right to abortion and even birth control. Don't let these people tell you, these so-called right-to-lifers, that the issue is the killing of innocent babies. The issue is the control over women exercised by forcing them to be mothers, whether or not they want to be at that time. Now, to have children, to raise children, can be a really beautiful experience if that's what you want to do and if you feel in a position to do it in the way that you feel that it should be done. But to have it forced on you is virtual enslavement. Not to even have the choice as to whether you will do that. And here's the key to how you know, or one key to how you know this is not about killing of innocent babies. Try to find one of these rabid anti-abortion groups that is also not opposed to birth control. You'll have a very hard time. They're all opposed to birth control because the issue is not the killing of innocent babies. It's the control and subordination of women who are regarded as getting all out of hand these days in this society, which is another reason why we have, or a contributing factor to why we have this vicious pornography. So the goal of these attacks on abortion and, yes, on birth control, the right to them, is to deny women the ability to determine something as basic as when or if they will have children and raise children or be part of raising them, forcing motherhood on them once again and enslaving them in that way. Along with all this, millions of women and girls, millions every year in this country alone, are raped, assaulted, battered, and abused, often by those who claim to be their intimate lovers, while the half of humanity that is female is everywhere treated as less than fully human. Once again, I think about the experience of black people in slavery. You know what one of the main terms the slave owners used to describe the slaves? Talking tools. Because this is how they regarded them, and this is how they were treated. They were put on the auction block to be sold, and their physical attributes were examined. Their teeth, if they were women, their reproductive potential, their body shapes, their ability to work hard, their musculature. All this was examined in the most degrading way. And you think of the same thing with women today, reduced to objects to be used by men, treated as brood animals to turn out babies, and as unthinking flesh to be consumed and plundered, with their bodies and body parts used to sell products, pimped out and beaten into submission, plundered to portray and promote sex as conquest and domination by men instead of shared pleasure based on mutual affection and equality. All of this degrades and demeans not only the women who are directly subjected to the most extreme forms of this, but all women everywhere. What kind of system is this? And why should anyone accept that this is the best possible way the world could be? And those whose sexual orientation is different from and seen as posing a threat to the dominant gender and sex relations, lesbians and gays, bisexual and transgendered people, or those who are simply unsure about their sexuality and questioning it at a given time, are harassed, bullied, often bullied to the point of committing suicide, brutalized, and even murdered. And despite certain changes in law and government policy, the reality of LGBT people being discriminated against, insulted, and even assaulted continues as a marked feature of the culture and society, bound up with deep-seated structural relations of this whole system, closely connected to the patriarchy and male supremacy that oppress women. Even those among the middle class, who may not directly experience much of the daily horror of this system, still live in a world deeply scarred by this, and have life cheapened, personal relations warped and poisoned, and dreams and horizons lowered and narrowed by the exploitative, oppressive, and destructive nature and functioning of this system, and the truly putrid culture that spews forth from it and serves to reinforce it. The masses of humanity and generations to come face the devastation of war, the destruction of the environment, and potential environmental catastrophe as their future. So yes, I say again, no more. But many, including many who hunger to see a world where all this truly is no more, often ask, can all this really be changed? And if so, how? Once more, to put an end to this and not to learn to put up with it, we need not the numbing consolation that it's all in God's hands or other false notions about reality. We need science, and in particular the science of communism, getting to the real reasons why things are the way they are in this world and what can and must be done to change all this and move beyond this madness. And we need urgently to build a movement for revolution that has this scientific approach and method as its foundation and guide.
All right, that was a segment from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. And that segment is taken from the film of his speech, and the film is called B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And you can pick up a copy of that film for yourself at revcom.us, all right? So check that out. And you can also get a compendium of Bob Avakian's work on the oppression of women and the solution to all that, where it comes from and what the solution is and how the world could be different, all right? You can get both of those things on the website revcom.us. Well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little something from Van Morrison called Educating Archie. Check this out.
Tell you up is down.